You're listening to The Star Spot, episode 54 for Sunday, June 1st, 2014.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at thestarspot. Astronomy meets Shakespeare? An unlikely pair, you might imagine, but there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Today, on this special audio and video edition of the show, I'm joined by Dan Falk at the Star Spot at the Toronto book launch of his new Science of Shakespeare. You can find the full video interview on our YouTube channel, The Star Spot TV. But first, here's what's current in space.
Surf's up for the tiniest surfers. It's an exciting day when we here at Starspot get to tell you that a new discovery has been made, but sometimes it's even more exciting when we get to say that new evidence has added greater complexity to old discoveries. Today is one of those days. Some weeks back, we shared with you a story about a probe in orbit of Titan, one of Saturn's moons, which detected that the hazy world has strangely still and eerily even oceans. Using extremely sensitive equipment aboard NASA's Cassini spacecraft, geophysicist Howard Zebker and his team declared that the second largest surface sea on Titan had mirror-like smoothness. The team used radar measurements with an accuracy down to the millimeter level, meaning that if any waves were hiding down there, they were so infinitesimal as to be invisible to us. Yet this might not be true. Well, it's almost certainly true for the Ligeia Mare, the lake studied by Zebker and his team, but that might not be universally true for the alien moon. A new study by planetary scientist Jason Barnes of the University of Idaho and his team is pointing in the direction that it isn't. The new study uses data from Cassini's Visible and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, or VIMS, and used a method not unlike that used in the Zebker study. By detecting light reflecting off the surface of Titan's 380-kilometer-wide Punga Mare, and just for reference, that could easily contain the largest lake in Africa within it, the team noticed strange variations that could be a sign of wave activity. This wave activity would be minimal, more ripples really, standing at a titanic and terrifying 2 centimeters high, but it would still be a landmark achievement, the first detection of waves outside of our comfortable little blue dot. The hope that the Punga Mare observations are waves combines with previous observations from the much smaller Kivu Lacus and other lakes that have possessed similar variations when watched by our eye in the Titanian sky. However, the data still requires additional verification if the suggestion is to be accepted. The possible wave action may simply be a methane mudflat, so keep that in mind before you don your summer spacesuit and head to the beach in the ultimate boonies. What's more, it's worth keeping in mind that you may have competition when you get there. Yes, I'm afraid it's impossible to get a good astronomy story without the mention of the possibility of alien life. If any life were to be able to form on Titan, it is unlikely it would form in still, placid conditions such as those detected by the Zebker team. No, life may need a little more motion to start a commotion riding the waves of an ocean, so goes the notion. Maybe when we at last get a probe to the surface of Titan, there will be locals to teach it to hang ten. Maybe not. If nothing else, every astronaut now has an excuse to practice their surfing skills.
Few things in our solar system are more fascinating than Jupiter's Great Red Spot. Nothing else is remotely comparable. It's a storm. A big storm. A very big storm. You can think of it as being akin to a hurricane, a colossal high-pressure anticyclonic storm that has been raging for at least the last 400 years since we humans have been observing the gas giant. It rotates anti-clockwise in the southern hemisphere with an approximate period of 6 days, generating formidable winds at nearly 400 kilometers per hour. The source of the red pinkish hue remains unknown, but some scientists have proposed sulfur and phosphorus causation. Back in the 1900s, astronomers estimated that at least three Earths could fit in the Great Red Spot, spanning about 41,000 kilometers across. However, recent observations from the Hubble Space Telescope, led by scientists at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, have unequivocally confirmed that Jupiter's trademarked spot is shrinking. In fact, it has been suggested to be shrinking by the late 1930s and early 1940s. The current Hubble measurements reveal that the diameter is now about 16,500 kilometers, making it the smallest it's ever been since astronomers have been observing it. This is following a shrinking trend also observed by Voyager 1 and 2 flyby measurements in 1979, measuring its diameter to be about 23,000 kilometers. The astronomers calculated that the Great Red Spot is dwindling at an astonishing 930 kilometers per year. The overall shape has also morphed from an oval to a more circular form. Of course, climate dynamics are extremely complicated, and computer simulations are never 100% predictively accurate, so the astronomers are still uncertain what is causing the rapid shrinking. Some hypotheses, like interfering eddy formation, are appealing and would explain how these small perturbations could cause an overall change in the internal energy dynamics and overall energy balance of the system. Does this mean that the storm will shrink into nothingness? The answer is probably not, but it is not impossible. Because of the sheer total energy of the system, which wouldn't completely dissipate easily, scientists are reluctant to say it will disappear altogether. However, it is not known if the shrinking will speed up or slow down, or if it will just one day stagnate. Apart from being a valuable resource in studying storm dynamics here on Earth, Jupiter's Great Red Spot will be sorely missed for its eerie beauty. It will be a sad day if and when it vanishes from our sight, leaving future generations longing for the lost wonder of our solar system.
And that's what's current in space.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. My name is Dustin. I am the host of Star Spot, the Star Spot podcast and radio show. I have some of my colleagues here as well. We're going to be tweeting during the interview and the rest of the evening. I'm really quite pleased to have been invited by Dan to conduct this interview with the Toronto launch of The Science of Shakespeare. Dan and I are friends. We've worked on a number of projects and events together, and this book was personally exciting to me when I heard about it, because I'm both a Shakespeare nut and an astronomy fan. So it was a perfect combination, as I'm sure it was for many of you, of those two interests that I had. And it was just a real delight to read. So congrats to Dan on getting that done. And I guess I want to start here, which is an interesting combination of those two seemingly different subjects. What motivated you? When did you know that you wanted to start writing this book, and why?
Yeah, so there were a couple of things that sort of pushed me in the direction of writing this book. From a general point of view, you know, Shakespeare and Galileo were born in the same year, 1564. And, oh, well, that's an interesting, you know, trivia answer to a trivia question if you're on Jeopardy or something. But I thought, all right, you know, Shakespeare is around when all these things are happening. We don't think of Shakespeare as a scientific figure, but he happens to be alive when Copernicus's theory comes out towards the end of Shakespeare's career. Galileo is looking through a telescope. Vesalius has published a textbook on anatomy. So, you know, with the advantage of hindsight, we can say the beginning stage of the scientific revolution is happening. So from that point of view, I thought, all right, let's look at this. An additional entry point was that about a decade ago, I was at a conference. It was the American Astronomical Society, and there was a retired astronomer there named Peter Usher, and he had sort of involved theory about Hamlet, and it's kind of controversial and, you know, perhaps a little far-fetched, but I thought, all right, at the very least it was interesting, and it got me thinking, and I thought, well, all right, if he's writing articles about this, then probably some other people too. And then finally the third thing was that, you know, I sort of looked at the calendar, I thought, Shakespeare's about to turn 450. Someone should write a book like this. And actually, the whole time I was writing, I thought, oh no, I bet someone else is writing a book like this. And it turns out, actually, nobody is. But that, so, yeah, Good thing I wrote it, I guess.
It's a bit of a departure. Your previous books, In Search of Time and Universe on a T-shirt, were very much about physics and science. A little bit of philosophy, of course, there as well. But then you, with this book, you turned to history and literature. And I'm wondering, what was most difficult about making that transition from more of the pure science to now bringing in science, where really it's to tell a story about the history, about the literature?
Yeah, so you're right. It was a departure. What it did have in common with the first two books is that there is this strong element of history. A history of science figures quite prominently in this book, and that's sort of my comfort zone, I guess. For those who don't know, I'm actually just completing an MA at the University of Toronto in history and philosophy of science, but it's something I've always been interested in, not to mention the physics and astronomy that lurks behind it. But the literature side, yeah, that for me is stepping out of my comfort zone, and although I've been a Shakespeare fan for many years, but certainly not any kind of expert. So it was quite a challenge to read up on the plays, you know, rent the videos, see the theatrical performances, read some of the criticism, and try to bring myself up to speed on what the Shakespeare community thinks about Shakespeare's, the setting that he was working in.
Now, as you say, one of the themes that come out of all of your books, I suppose, is you talk about the scientific revolutions during the historical period in which the science of what would become the modern theory was really born. But in this book, you look further at that whole concept of revolution, scientific revolution, the Copernican revolution, and what you find is that they never really happened. There never really was a revolution. And I mean, can you explain whether that nomenclature, that idea of there being a revolution, is that exaggerated? How does change actually happen?
Wow. Okay, so that's a good question. It's hard to give a really concise answer to that. And of course, this is the kind of thing that historians write whole, volumes on. So there was a fellow, Steve Chapin, I think, at Harvard, who wrote a book a few years ago, and everybody loves quoting the first sentence of this book. So he wrote a book, I think, called The Scientific Revolution, and the first sentence, if I have this right, is there was no such thing as a scientific revolution, and this book is about it. Something like that. And you know, historians are maybe a little funny, but he has a good point, which is that change always happens gradually, and the people who were alive at that time did not know that they were having a scientific revolution, right? Right now, I guess we think we're in the information age or the internet age, but historians 400 years from now might call this something else. And we just wouldn't be aware of it. So, was there a scientific revolution? Well, the way I see it is, it's sort of a judgment call whether you want to use the word revolution, but there were a lot of very interesting explorations of the natural world or a lot of discoveries. So, for a century already, sailors have been exploring what we now call America, Africa, Asia, that is European explorers. And towards the end of this period, Galileo actually looks at new worlds, literally. The moon, the discovery of four moons revolving around Jupiter. Again, Vesalius is writing books about the human body and correcting mistakes that the ancient Greeks had been, perpetuating for a couple of millennia. So there really were scientific, shall we say, discoveries happening. Whether there was a revolution or not, I think historians can debate.
So we have the ancient ways of looking, and those only leave very gradually. And I suppose one of the arguments against there being a revolution is that a lot of those ancient ways of seeing the world don't exactly disappear overnight. And one of those is this idea that what happens in the heavenly domain is connected to what happens on Earth. So like a comet is an omen of war, usually something very bad. And I'm curious, let's talk about Shakespeare now. Does Shakespeare seem to be committed to this way of seeing the world, this intimate connection? Is that still there between the heavens and the earth?
Well, that's a really good question. He's certainly conscious of it because he talks about it, or that is to say his characters talk about it. Now, this is very tricky, right? So in the world of Shakespeare scholarship, or perhaps literary criticism in general, you get into this very tricky business of, you have a drama or you have a novel and the characters speak. Are the characters speaking for the writer? I don't know. I mean, that's just something that is endlessly debated, and there's probably no way of answering that. But in Shakespeare's plays, we have characters who sort of express different sides of this. So, as you said, there were people who believed in a very intimate connection between sort of worldly, terrestrial matters, family affairs, politics, national, nation states, conflict, wars, and things that we don't seem to have any control over, things in the heavens, the comings and goings of meteors, comets, what the planets are doing, astrological happenings. Did Shakespeare see it that way? Well, some of his characters did, But something what I find really interesting is that he also has characters who really reject it and reject it very strongly. So I think that's quite interesting.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about specific developments that were happening. The telescope, Galileo, 1609, publishing his findings about the craters on the moon, the now called the Galilean, the four Galilean moons of Jupiter. Do we see evidence in the evolution of the canon of the works of Shakespeare that these that specific discoveries are known to Shakespeare and actually are being used as literary devices, if you will, in these plays?
So that's sort of the big question, and quite controversial, I guess, because the general view of most Shakespeare scholars is that, you know, sort of no, he didn't, for whatever reason, he didn't tackle it in the way that other writers did. John Donne, you know, says the new philosophy calls all in doubt, very, very famous. But John Donne was writing, a couple years later, John Donne was writing in response to Galileo very explicitly. Milton, very much involved in this debate between the old and the new ways of seeing the cosmos, but Milton was writing 50 years later. So a lot of people said Shakespeare, you know, doesn't, you know, when he talks about the heavens, which he does a lot, then it seems sort of medieval. But I did find, you know, a few scholars who think maybe that's a bit too simple. Maybe there are hints of it, some hints in Hamlet, and I don't know how much you want me to give away, and perhaps especially towards the end of Shakespeare's career, some very interesting hints in the play Cymbeline may suggest that
this is after Galileo is published.
Just after, a few months.
There's only
after
a few plays, I think, you talk about.
Well,
that come after
because Galileo's book comes out in the spring of 1610, and Shakespeare retired. You know, it's funny using phrases like Shakespeare retires. I mean, he retired, and you know, did he know that he was going to die 3 years later? Maybe not. Maybe he thought he was just going to go home, visit his family, and then come back and write. I mean, who knows, right? But he dies in 1616, and so there is just this short window, right? There's a window of 5 or 6 years from Galileo to when Shakespeare dies.
I want to turn now to talk about some of the specific plays themselves. You touched on Cymbeline and Hamlet and others. And of course, Shakespeare, as you say, wasn't writing science. He was writing stories in the form of plays. So when Shakespeare does reference astronomy, and maybe we can talk a little bit about one example, the pole star, which is referenced in a few of his plays.
Yes.
Should we take this as scientific, literal fact, or is this literary, is he using it as a literary device? You know, the way the pole star can be used as a symbol of something not so astronomical.
I think it might be both. I mean, at the very least, it's sort of a narrative device that moves the story forward. A sort of a classic example is in Julius Caesar. Many of you know the play. It's one of the, quote, easier plays. You get it in high school and first year university. There's a scene in, I forget if it's Act 2 or Act 3, but the citizens of Rome are petitioning Caesar because there was an issue of he banished one guy's brother, and they're upset. They want him to lift the order of banishment. So they've sort of surrounded him at the entrance to the Senate, saying, come on, you know, give us a break. And he says, this is not exactly, I'm paraphrasing, he says, you know, I am constant as the northern star, right? Other people can be swayed, but you're not going to sway me because I'm constant like the pole star. So there's a bit of astronomy 101 that's in there, and you have to imagine that the audience in 1598 would get this. They would get this reference. But, you know, is it more than that? I'm not sure. But at the very least, it's, you know, I think it's important that people, I think, were a bit on friendlier terms with the sky than we are now. I mean, today with light pollution, a lot of people would be hard-pressed to say, you know, what phase the moon is in right now, or whether Venus is in the morning sky or the evening sky, whereas I think back then you simply would have known because it was just something you saw every day.
Well, this is an example where, I mean, knowing that fact about astronomy, that fact about the full appreciation of the text, right, of what Shakespeare is trying to say about Julius Caesar. Is it fair to say that if you're not literate in science, that you are missing a significant contribution to the depth of these plays?
I guess so. I mean, Shakespeare touches on so many things. It's hard to be an expert in all the different things that you would have to be an expert in to get all his little sly, you know, asides and references. I mean, when you're in high school, I think that the teacher sort of purposely doesn't tell you like all the sexual innuendo that's in the plays. But if you crack open a good scholarly edition, it might make it more enjoyable or whatever. It's at least what's good for a few laughs. But, you know, it's actually like everywhere, like every page, there's like something that's incredibly dirty. And it's not even the stuff, because the language has sort of evolved, so it's not even necessarily the things that sound dirty. It's like it's the stuff that sounds kind of tame, and then turns out, oh, I guess it also meant that. The you know, the scientific or astronomical allusions, well, yeah, I guess, I think it is good. I mean, if people don't know So I'm biased because I'm like a, you know, an astronomy nerd. I've been an amateur astronomer for many years, and I just think everybody should know that when you look at the sky over a period of hours or days, the pole star stays put and all the other stuff kind of revolves around it. You know, I think everybody should know that, but I appreciate that maybe not everyone has that tidbit of knowledge, but yeah, I think it would help.
How many people in this room think everybody should know that? I'm just curious. I do. I want to also bring in some of the cast of characters in your book, and I'm not only talking about the characters in the plays, but some of these historical figures. Galileo, we all know. Kepler, most of us have at least heard of. Thomas Diggs, I'm not even trying to pronounce that right. That's how obscure the name is, but it should be obscure, as you argue. He's a kind of a pivotal character in your book. Why? Who is he?
Well, I think he's gotten a bit of a short shrift, maybe, in history. Thomas Diggs was an English astronomer. He wasn't just an astronomer. He was also a member of Parliament and a military engineer. So he got sort of called on to do different projects. So he wasn't always doing astronomy. But he did, for example, observe the supernova of 1572. This was a star that sort of burst forth into the skies in the constellation Cassiopeia. New stars aren't supposed to ever happen because the ancient Greeks sort of developed a view in which the stars are kind of eternal. So it's kind of shocking. And he observed it in detail, so did another fellow, Tycho Brahe, from Denmark and other astronomers of the time. And there's a lot of, again, I could either give a long or short answer, but Thomas Diggs, his family had sort of connections to Shakespeare. That's quite interesting. They were neighbors in North London for a while. Thomas Diggs dies in 1595, which is actually quite early in Shakespeare's career, but we have reason to believe that Shakespeare knew Diggs's sons, and in fact Diggs's widow goes on to remarry. She marries one of Shakespeare's friends. We know that because the guy Thomas Russell that she marries ends up being one of the executors of Shakespeare's will. So it's kind of interesting. Some connections there by which maybe, I mean, it's all kind of speculative, but some routes by which Shakespeare could have come across some of these ideas.
And you just mentioned Tycho Brahe, and we should pause there for a moment and connect that to, I guess, the play that's probably gotten more attention than any other in terms of many things, but especially the science of Shakespeare, and that's Hamlet. Can you take us through from the more mainstream to the exceedingly speculative some of the ideas about how Hamlet in particular has come to be a bit of a flashpoint, is it safe to say, in terms of this new area of scholarship?
Yeah, I can try. So Hamlet is the longest of Shakespeare's plays by quite a wide margin. If you ever see it uncut, it's like 4 hours, and for that reason it's actually almost never done uncut. People always chop things out of it. The Kenneth Branagh film, I think, is almost, you know, cut free. I don't remember if it's 3.5 or if it's, you know, if they actually left every single line in. There's a BBC version on you can get that's, I think, the whole shebang. So there's a natural tendency to think that if Shakespeare was going to do something clever, you know, it would be in Hamlet somewhere. And this astronomer that I mentioned earlier, Peter Usher, has kind of done that. He's sort of looking for certain things in the play and reaches some, I think, maybe some extravagant conclusions. But there are some very interesting things there. I'll just mention one, and then you can let me know if you want more examples. But one interesting one is that the names of the characters in Hamlet, and it's a big play with a long list of characters, and now you've got, you know, Claudius, Ophelia, people with fairly classical-sounding names, and then you've got two names that really stand out, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, the two courtiers, who really do have very Danish-sounding names, and you might want to know how Shakespeare came across those names, since Shakespeare never left England, and there's a couple of possible answers, but the one that a few scholars have found really interesting is that Tycho Brahe actually had members, I don't know if they were cousins, but members of his family with that name, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So then you get into, well, how did Shakespeare know that? And there are different answers to that, but there's a sort of well-known engraving, a copperplate engraving that Tycho had done of himself, but, you know, sort of posing very grandly in the middle, and he's got these family crests of his illustrious family members on the outside, and you see the two names, and so that, we're pretty sure, was sent to some of his astronomical colleagues in England. Did it end up in the hands of Thomas Diggs? Quite possibly. We don't know for sure. And then from there, did Shakespeare see it? Again, we don't know. I mean, it was also published, so Shakespeare could have seen it when he was sort of browsing in the bookstore. Or it's a coincidence, and he just liked the sound of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
And the theories get more and more speculative. I won't go into detail because we don't have a lot of time and we want to sell those books. So I'll have to leave it to you to read more about it. But I found that was particularly intriguing. And the fact in particular that many mainstream scholars have suggested or have at least accepted that there's something to this, if not, you know, not that the whole play necessarily is pushing towards one particular cosmological view, but that there is a lot of really underappreciated science in Shakespeare, or in Hamlet in particular.
Well, I think at the very least there's, you know, there's something a little funny about, you know, there's something about a connection to Thomas Diggs and perhaps Tycho Brahe and the names Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There's some other, again, I know we don't have time to get into it, there's some question as to whether there's a star that's seen in Act 1, Scene 1. It's used as kind of a clock because the guards, Horatio asks the guards, so when did you see this ghostly figure? And they said, well, when yon same star that's westward from the pole was where it now is. And he actually doesn't get to finish the sentence because all of a sudden the ghost appears and then, you know, they have to deal with that. But so scholars are wondering, well, what is the star? What is yon same star westward from the pole? And could it be the supernova that I was mentioning earlier? You know, maybe. So that's, but it's not, this is not something that all or even, I think, many Shakespeare scholars are into, because Shakespeare scholarship is this huge field and literary criticism is a big thing. But for a few people, you know, this is like a really cool topic to maybe investigate a bit further.
I want to ask you about just one other play that we might focus on, and that's King Lear, which I guess is often seen as a rival to Hamlet, of the two of them being the top two plays of Shakespeare. I think it's safe to say, getting back to that early conversation we had about revolutions, that there certainly were upheavals in Elizabethan England in terms of traditional beliefs being overturned and the sense that everything was cast into doubt. And these are themes that really permeate that particular play of King Lear. Do you think that in that play Shakespeare is realizing kind of the importance of the age he's living in, that if not necessarily science specifically, but traditional ways of seeing the world, authority in particular, were being overturned?
I think it's hard to not to wonder about that. Yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier this question of astrology, and we were talking about these connections between, you know, sort of the heavens and the earth. Sometimes it's called the macrocosm, microcosm connection, which certain characters, I mean, the example that hits home for me is, I think it's in Act 2, where Gloucester is having a conversation with his illegitimate son, Edmund, and, you know, Gloucester expresses a very long-winded, highly what we today call superstitious view. It begins, these late eclipses of the sun and moon portend no good to us, and there actually were eclipses a year or two before Shakespeare was writing the play, so some people think that inspired him. I actually don't think that's critical, because it's not a secret that solar and lunar eclipses happen, so we could just invoke them for drama. But, you know, Gloucester gives this very long speech about how this is causing terrible things to happen. You know, fathers turning against sons, and, you know, in palaces, discord, and in countries, treason. And he goes on, and then he leaves the room, and Edmund takes just a completely different view and says, you know, this is the excellent foppery of the world, that, you know, that when, now I'm only paraphrasing, but when bad things happen, usually because it's our own fault, we just, you know, we blame the stars, and we blame anyone but ourselves. So I think there's that, and there is, you know, they're always asking the gods to sort of to intervene and to help them and, you know, to show the world more just, but as, you know, there's a famous line where one of the characters says, you know, as flies are to wanton boys, are we to the gods? They kill us for their sport. So it's, you know, what was Shakespeare's view? That's perhaps impossible to discern, but he does seem to be exploring some kind of bold idea, perhaps frightening ideas to some people. So I think there is some of that going on in King Lear.
Your studies into the science of Shakespeare is itself kind of bold and perhaps frightening to some, and I'm wondering if in looking at the history of scholarship, the fact that the science really has been the guilty of the so-called war between science and the humanities, is it sort of that humanity sees Shakespeare as its own and science should keep out, and only now is science starting to look into, you know, Shakespeare and seeing if there is a role for science there?
There might be. I hadn't thought of it in that sort of in dramatic terms, but I mean, perhaps. I mean, it's not a secret that, you know, 50 years ago, C.P. Snow wrote a book called, what was it called again?
The Two Cultures.
The Two Cultures. Shame on me, I should have that memorized. The Two Cultures, and he was kind of lamenting that, yes, that the arts, including, you know, music and literature and you know, plays and poems and all that had gone one way and science was going another way, and there's very little interaction between the two, and as a result, people are losing something because scientists are ignorant of the arts, allegedly, and arts people are ignorant of the sciences, and there's probably something to that, although today there's actually a lot of very, very interesting collaborations and interactions, which is a whole other topic, but I think I'm in favor of those, and I think they're a good thing. So the two cultures thing might be one reason why it's been neglected. It could be a bit more harmless than that. It could just be that Shakespeare is a big, big topic, and people quite legitimately want to talk about politics and sort of psychology and philosophy. Well, actually, if they get into psychology, that's another entryway into some of the scientific subjects. But, you know, religion, you can just write about father-daughter relations, and that can be your whole thing for Shakespeare, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can
theses. So
absolutely, yeah.
And if you choose that subject, you know, yours won't be the first. These are very rich subjects. Sexuality. It just goes on and on. And you could just check in your local library, look at the Shakespeare section, and all these things are explored in great detail. And science, yeah, there's a few titles. There's just not many. I will say that about 90 years ago, a guy named Cumberland Clark sort of did this. He wrote a book called Science and Shakespeare, and that's long enough ago, it's been completely forgotten, so that's good. And he also sort of didn't do it. Well, and I don't think his conclusion, if I remember, was sort of like that there's not that much to it, so it was sort of that sort of a book. So maybe it's been a bit neglected, not necessarily due to anti-science sentiment in the humanities, but, I mean, there could be many reasons.
Just in our last couple of minutes here, I wanted to ask you if you could maybe offer some concluding thoughts, and maybe by commenting in particular on a quote. You had an interview with Colin McGinn, the philosopher, mm-hmm. and he described Shakespeare as being pre-scientific but post-magical, a pre-scientific naturalist. Is that how you conclude in terms of your studies into this area?
I think that's a very helpful way of looking at Shakespeare. I mean, we have to be very cautious, and you know, just in the last few days, there have been people in the blogosphere getting a little antsy and taking issue with some of the claims I make in the book, and of course that's fine, it's good to have a healthy debate. You know, maybe some claims I make are a little too strong. Well, perhaps. But there's no getting around that Shakespeare was a transitional figure. He was aware of these traditional very sort of mystical, magical ways of seeing the world. We know, you know, some of the characters express those views very explicitly. So that was in the air. You know, people were seeking folk remedies for illnesses. People were accusing each other of being witches. People were casting horoscopes. All these things were going on. Shakespeare is extremely conscious of that, as I'm sure is his audience. But I think you do get a taste of some newer ideas, and we've been mentioning a few of them tonight. And you know, as I sort of joke in the book, I mean, it's not like Shakespeare was this Carl Sagan-like figure getting us to abandon superstition and, you know, go science, woohoo, because that would be ridiculous to take that extreme a position. But he is a transitional figure, and the modern world is just sort of the first little taste of the modern world is coming into existence while Shakespeare is writing his plays, and I think that's very interesting.
Really appreciated the book. I was kind of pondering why I was so driven to continue reading it. I mean, I read it, you know, voraciously, and I realize it's a mystery book. It's really a puzzle of science history. I think that's the way I would come at this, because you're trying to understand some layers of the history of science and how it impacted a figure like Shakespeare, what he knew, how did he get that knowledge, where does it show up in the canon, that kind of thing. And to me, that's a historical puzzle. And I'm wondering if maybe you can comment on the psychology. Is there sort of a human need to solve puzzles, to understand not just knowledge, but also where it comes from, how it impacts the rest of society beyond just the science?
Oh, that's a tough one, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I think we do want to understand. It's part of this, probably this grand mystery of how did the modern world come into being? And of course, historians explore this, and you don't want to fall into the trap of what they call Whig history, where you only place value on the things from 400 years ago that look modern, right? And you just sweep everything else under the rug. So that can be a trap that you have to be cautious about. But yes, if you're not sure, you know, you have someone as important as Shakespeare, and we're not quite sure what he thought about this or what he thought about that, and to be sure, we don't have his diaries or his letters, so there's a lot of sort of blanks in terms of what he actually did think about things. We do have the sonnets, but you have to be very careful about taking them biographically. So yeah, I think there is a sort of a yearning to know like what he thought about things. Especially, like I mentioned earlier, we sort of have a more clear picture of what John Donne thought, what John Milton thought. So we'd love to know that. And at the far end of the spectrum, you've got, you know, the conspiracy theorists and people who say, well, Shakespeare couldn't have been Shakespeare. Shakespeare had to have been someone else. And I do get those emails sort of a lot. But there's also, I think, room for a very healthy desire to fill in some of these blanks. I think that's natural for historians, and I guess natural for anyone, not to be a professional historian, just natural for anyone interested in what I think is a really pivotal and really interesting period in history.
Thanks so much, Dan. Dan's agreed to take some questions, I think, say maybe 5 minutes or so. We don't
sure, yeah, and thank you, Justin. Those are really good questions. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to do it.
Do you want me to...
Yeah, take it away.
Them? All right, well, it looks like Carrie has her hand up. Carrie runs a book club, so it's going to be a really good question.
That's a lot of pressure, Dan. So just to sort of jumping on what you were just asking about, this whole issue of, you know, Shakespeare, did Shakespeare really write these plays and all these things? Does the book talk about that sort of thing? I mean, does it even address that whole issue of, was Shakespeare really Shakespeare? And I mean, again, I don't know that would change the science at all. I mean,
sure.
If a play was written at a particular time, it was, regardless of whether or not Shakespeare wrote it. But I mean, do you talk about that at all?
So Carrie's question is, do I talk about this issue of whether Shakespeare was Shakespeare or whether Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare, in which case somebody else would have to be Shakespeare? And it's a right, you know, and It is, and people have been asking that. I mean, Mark Twain, you know, some very smart people asked it. Just 3 weeks ago, a retired U.S. Supreme Court justice was sort of making this point, so a lot of very clever people have wanted to know. And yes, I do talk about it for a few paragraphs, but I don't think it's going to give it too much away. I think Shakespeare was Shakespeare. So, sorry about that. I mean, you could probably get a sort of a juicier story if Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare.
I was just curious, because I mean that could obviously belabor a point that really has nothing to do with what your book's about anyway. I was just curious.
Yeah, no, I mean it's a legit question, and again, you know, some scholars do pursue that. The ones I interviewed, I mean, maybe it's worth mentioning, although the majority, I mean, basically all but one were on the side of Shakespeare having been Shakespeare, but the one guy that I talked to said Shakespeare was, well, he thinks Shakespeare was one of the astronomers, and so, you know, he has a whole thing for that, and so I talk about it. It's tricky, because the astronomer that he thinks was Shakespeare died a little too early, by a dozen years or something like that. But there are always ways around that, right? I mean, the people who think Shakespeare was Edward de Vere, the Earl of Oxford, also have to deal with that. Some of you saw the movie, right? There was a movie about 2 years ago called Anonymous, and it was about exactly this. It was about Edward de Vere having been Shakespeare, and it's a fun film. I enjoyed it, by the way. But the way they get around it, because again, Oxford dies too soon, but he sort of puts the plays like in a chest or something, and then Ben Jonson. But I hope that doesn't give anything. It's a good movie. It's kind of a fun movie. And they even got Derek Jacobi, a world-respected Shakespeare scholar, to sort of, you know, at the start of the movie, he comes on stage and does like a little blurb. And I mean, you know, he probably got paid good money for that. But it's, you know, there's some actors who would just never ever do that. But clearly, Jacobi is at least somewhat sympathetic to this idea of Shakespeare not having been Shakespeare, so...
He played closest thing.
What? Oh, did he? I don't remember. Yeah, IMDb would know, but I don't know. I mean, he's a big time... It's a good question. Yeah, it looks like Tammy has a question.
What is the most surprising tidbit you found out in your research?
The most surprising tidbit? I'll give... Yeah, I think what caught me by surprise... it has to do with Montaigne, so bear with me, because this takes a minute or so to answer, but many of you will know that there was this French statesman and writer named Michel de Montaigne. I apologize for my French pronunciation, and he wrote the statesmanship is, it would all be sort of forgotten, except what we remember him for is this volume of essays, and it was published in several volumes. I don't remember the exact years, but towards the end of the 1500s, there was also an English translation in 1603 by John Florio, which we believe Shakespeare got his hands on. It's a bit stronger than that. We sort of know Shakespeare got his hands on it because he plagiarizes from it, or I guess the more polite word would be is inspired by it, something like that. He lifts a number of passages, but the long one is in The Tempest. So in The Tempest, Gonzalo or somebody, I sometimes forget characters' names, but somebody in The Tempest is saying, well, you know, it'd be sort of paradise if there were no laws and no taxes and we could just do whatever we want and take our clothes off and it would all be fun. Paraphrasing. And that's out of an essay called On the Cannibals, which is one chapter of The Apology for Raymond Savant. I think. Well, it doesn't really matter. It's in Montaigne's essays. We know Shakespeare basically ripped that off for The Tempest. Montaigne, so it's a description of, you probably might be wondering where Montaigne got it. He was talking to someone who brought native South Americans back. So somebody went to Brazil and brought natives. It's like it's not a good thing that this person did that, but he brought Brazilian natives back to France, and I guess Montaigne saw them, or at least heard about them, and was very intrigued by it, and wrote that in his essay. So all right, so that's, everybody know, everybody, Shakespeare scholars who are into this kind of thing have long known, for about 150 years, scholars have known that Montaigne is a big, you know, vital source for Shakespeare. I started reading Montaigne, and it's incredibly long. The Penguin edition is about 1,000 pages. And I didn't read every single word, but I was sort of like looking for the juicy bits and stuff. And what got me is that Montaigne mentions Copernicus. And I was kind of excited about that, because I've read, you know, a few biographies of Montaigne, and they don't talk about that. And the books about Shakespeare that mention Montaigne don't say anything about that at all. So I was like, ooh, what an awesome, grand discovery, because, I mean, I now know, thanks to the blogosphere, that, yeah, people know this, and my conclusions about it are wrong, allegedly wrong. But here's my, you know, my claim, which you can imagine, is Shakespeare read Montaigne mentions Copernicus, therefore Shakespeare knew about Copernicus. I mean, I don't mean it literally he must have, because it's a thought, well, I don't know how long Florio's translation was. It's a very long book. If Shakespeare was just skimming, like, what if he didn't buy it? What if he was just skimming in the bookstore and just kind of got what he needed? Well, we all do this, right? He got the juicy bit. He got the bit about the Brazilian natives and thought, oh, hey, this thing I'm working on about the island with the magician and you know, the fairies and stuff, this is going to be awesome for that, and then he left, so then he wouldn't have read the bit about Copernicus. But it's interesting to think that maybe that's one way by which he would have got it. Doesn't at all mean he endorsed it. And by the way, Montaigne doesn't endorse Copernicus. What he says, and I hope I'm not giving away all the best parts, you should still totally buy the book, what Montaigne says, it's very forward looking, and again, you know, the whole kind of science thing, I think, is maybe looming in the background, maybe even a bit of Karl Popper, for those of you who know your philosophy of science. Montaigne says something like, well, in the old days, the ancients saw the universe such and such a way. And then in recent times, Copernicus, again, who he names, Copernicus sees it in this other way, and who knows if in 1,000 years we'll see the universe in a different way yet again. So it's a very interesting line, and, you know, very, very compelling, and, you know, it gave me a warm and fuzzy feeling when I saw that, and I thought, you know, all the usual things that would go through a writer's mind. It's like, oh my God, I'm the first person who noticed that Montaigne. No, obviously people, the six people who are really into that already knew about that. But it is not mentioned, or hardly ever that I've seen mentioned in writings about Shakespeare. So I thought that was cool. So probably a longer answer than what you wanted, but that's one of the sort of cooler things that I found when I was immersing myself in all of this. I guess Phil has a question.
Yeah. So Dan, you clearly spent a lot of time looking at the scholarship that's out there on this topic. What I'm curious about is, did you also spend time yourself going through the canon with a microscope, looking for clues, that kind of thing?
Yeah, a little bit. So the question is, did I sort of comb the Shakespeare canon with a, you know, fine-tooth comb or whatever, looking for things? So yeah, kinda. I mean, I don't know if, I probably shouldn't admit this. I don't think I got through every, you know, every play. Oh, there's a lot. There can't sell so much writing, and who has that kind of time? But no, I try. I mean, it's actually made a bit easier by the fact that people have already looked through everything you could possibly look through. Now, they haven't necessarily drawn the same conclusions that you would draw, but, you know, you can read some scholarly articles, like, about a play, and then you get a certain knowledge. Yeah, so I mean, I did go through many of them, and then You know, I can put in a plug for this DVD set that I got, because it was totally the best $100 I ever spent. It was the BBC, I guess these were probably filmed in the 80s, maybe, from the look of them. Performances by the Royal Shakespeare Company, filmed by the BBC, and I found them on eBay, being sold by a Korean reseller, and it was terrific. It's a 40 DVD set, and you get to choose between English and Korean subtitles, but I watched them with the English subtitles because they're sort of verbatim. They took it directly from, you know, the Oxford University Press or one of the scholarly editions, and so they didn't it's not modernized. It's the original English, which actually without the subtitles you can easily, or at least this is what I found, you can easily miss words because there's very strange, you know, what to us is very unusual turns of phrase and that sort of thing. So. And now you're wondering, well, at least did you watch all 40 DVDs? I watched most of the DVDs. You know, come over sometime and we'll watch The Merry Wives of Windsor and, we'll hang out and we'll get through some of the lesser plays. But, sure.
My question is, I see that you took some field trips.
Right. I almost forgot that was going on. I apologize that the writing is small, as seen from the back of the room, but yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So which places have you been to, and how long have you been researching for the book, and did you leave out anything from the book that you wanted to include, but you didn't because of the maybe space and things like that?
Well, to answer the last part first, I mean, I think all the stuff that I really, really wanted to say is in the book. I mean, it was challenging to write for many reasons, and you know, I won't go through all the sort of agonies of, oh, life as a writer is so difficult, and, you know, how do you structure this, and if that's in chapter 4, but then you have to make the same point again in chapter 8, and, oh, you know, it is a lot of work, and it is very challenging, and a lot of it was way outside of my comfort zone, although parts were not. The parts about the history of science, I have some degree of comfort in, and that sort of takes up the first couple of chapters, because I ease people into it. Where did I go? That's pretty easy. I went to Stratford and I went to London. Probably didn't have to, because you can't find anything that people didn't know was, you know, I mean, they're all sort of tourist sites, right? But I thought it would be cool to go, so I did. And also some museums and some libraries. The museums were actually pretty good. I'll leave that for you to discover in the book, but, you know, there are some, like, little hidden nooks in the Museum of Science in London that are not part of the stuff that's normally open to the public, so I don't want to tell you what it is, because I've already thought, I saw a thing that, was important to an astronomer that we may have been talking about. Actually, no, it's an astronomer that we didn't get around to talking about, sort of a magician astronomer kind of guy, and he had a thing, and so I saw his thing in a drawer in the annex of the part of the Science Museum that is not open to public. Not even South Kensington. You have to take the bus to somewhere in Hammersmith or somewhere further out, and then you have to be let in. Anyway, so yeah, that was super fun, and I went into, now some of you have been to this because it's another, this one is open to the public, but there's the old operating theater and Herb Garrett Museum. So that's in Southwark. It's actually very close to what this new skyscraper, right? The Shard, right? It's this weird pyramid-like thing that is the tallest building in London now, or something like that. So, so there's a museum that takes you through the history of medicine, mostly more recent history, like sort of 19th century, although even that is kind of horrifying enough to look at the instruments they used, and bearing in mind that anesthetic didn't really exist and stuff like that. So although there aren't too many artifacts left over from the early 17th century, but it's still very interesting to look at, and, you know, I interviewed the guy there. So yeah, it was fun kind of doing those sort of explorations, and, I mean, I've visited some of the cities where some of the experts live, but, yeah, nothing too extravagant. A bit of traveling. It's always kind of fun. You know, even if you're just taking photos that everybody's taken 100 times before, it's, you know, it's kind of fun seeing Anne Hathaway's cottage and Mary Arden's house and Shakespeare's birthplace. So yeah, it's kind of cool. Jenny.
Hey, what's your favorite Shakespeare play, and who's your favorite astronomer?
Well, you're only the second person ever to ask me which is my favorite play, and nobody's asked me who my favorite astronomer is. But I got to think about that. Favorite play, well, I guess it's Macbeth. I like Macbeth because Did I say something? What's wrong?
Scottish play.
Scottish play.
Don't.
You're on stage.
Yeah, right.
On stage.
Okay. Warning appreciated. Is there a big yeah, okay, but like, I mean, I think you know me pretty well, like, I don't go in for that kind of thing, but, no, it's all good. But no, I like Macbeth because, first of all, I think I can admit this, it's one of the easier, like, you can sort of follow it, right? It's not a super complicated play, and, you know, he meets the witches near the beginning. Well, first there's a bloody soldier who wanders in, you know, there's blood everywhere, saying, all right, that's kind of cool, all right? And then the witches say, this is going to happen, and he says, well, hey, that's crazy. But then those things start to happen, and that's really cool, right? Yeah. So, I like Macbeth, and again, sort of, you can sort of make sense of it, and I guess, it's kind of funny because I thought that it was one of the first plays that I saw, so I say in the introduction, that's one of the first plays that I saw, but then my dad has all these diaries going back to like the early 1960s or something, so anything that has to be fact-checked, we just get dad to look through his old diaries, and of course, his diaries suggest something completely different, that the first play we went to see together was Midsummer Night's Dream or something like that, and stuff. So, you know, like, well, check the next year, maybe we went to see Macbeth. So I don't know, I went to see Macbeth with mom and dad at some point, but maybe it wasn't really the first play that I saw. I don't know. But yeah, it's always been kind of a favorite. Favorite astronomer, that's a tough one. You know, it's like favorite Beatle or something like that. I can't remember if you asked me favorite Beatle or not.
George.
Favorite astronomer, well, I mean, Tycho Brahe was quite a character, right? So Tycho Brahe was in a duel when he was a younger man and got part of his nose chopped off. So that's interesting. Very dramatic. You don't get that, I mean, yeah, people argue with each other on the internet, but I don't think an astronomer has got his nose chopped off since that day. So, I mean, that's dramatic, and then he saw the supernova, so that's interesting. He was also very pompous, not that that's an attractive quality, but I mean, his writings have this kind of flavor to them that makes them kind of entertaining, right? So when he talks in the thing that he published about the supernova, he says, and then I saw this thing in the sky, and since, you know, from childhood I have known all the stars in the heavens perfectly, I immediately noticed that this unusual star, brighter than any other, so I was like, really? You know, but that's kind of fun, right? So Tycho Brahe, and then there's the whole mysterious Rosencrantz Guildenstern thing, so... Oh, and there's the story of how, this is in, like, described in my first book, but there's the story of his death. Which is quite interesting. Why am I smiling when I'm talking about his death? Well, it's because he died in a sort of unusual way, right? So he was at this dinner party. He had to flee Denmark when the king... Long story, interesting, but I'm going to skip it, about why he was no longer in the favor of the king of Denmark. So he ran off to Prague and worked for the emperor and met Johann Kepler, which is terrific. And then he was at a dinner party in honor of some other nobleman, and he drank a bit too much, but the etiquette said that he shouldn't ask to be excused from the table while his host was still sitting. So he sat there, and I guess he had to go really badly. Anyway, there were some complications, and I think 11 days later he was dead. I mean, you know, he may have had some other condition too. So I don't know if we have anyone here from the Czech Republic, but supposedly there's a saying that translates as... I don't want to die like Tycho Brahe. It basically just means I really have to go. So that's Tycho Brahe. So, you know, favorite, I don't know if he's my favorite, but yeah, he's like, wow, like he's kind of cool. And, you know, and I mean, I've seen his tomb there in the church in Prague, and it's like, you should have gone. Yeah. That's a good question, yeah. So maybe he's my favorite astronomer. All right, so if I don't... Chris, yeah. Looks like Chris has a question.
So there's a slide that has a... sorry, photography question. A slide that is Star Trails. That was not shot near Stratford Pond Avenue, correct?
Probably. So, full confession...
I'm trying to blow your covers.
No, it's... I mean...
I'm curious about where.
Some of these images were stolen from... They have this thing now called the internet. That Star Trails image was stolen from the internet, but I have taken many of my own Star Trail photos. I took some of them with Chris in different parts of the world, but I was too lazy to find what hard drive they're on, blah, blah, blah. So that image is stolen from the internet. But yes, it almost certainly was not shot from England, because it's hard to do that kind of thing from England. Yeah.
It would have been awesome if it was from
England. Yeah. The reason I put that one up there was to just, I mean, it illustrates the constant as the Northern Star thing. So that line from Julius Caesar, although I don't think I had the text on it. But yeah, so it was just to get people thinking about that. All the stars seem to go around this spot in the sky, and just by coincidence, there could have been no star there at all. But it happens that we have a fairly bright star called Polaris that's there. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. And for those who are really into history of astronomy, there's precession of equinoxes, and because of that, Polaris has not always been and will not always be the pole star. So if you wait a couple of thousand years, you get a different star to be the pole star, and that's like the whole thing, which Shakespeare probably didn't know about. But the ancient Greeks did, because they knew a lot of stuff. Oh, Jamie.
So three quick questions. One is, what's the next event at which you'll be talking about your book that we can help promote? What's next for you in your literary lineup? And where can we buy the book and how?
Well, I think these are all trick questions. I think Jamie actually knows the answer to some of these. And I think Jamie's just being awesome, which is great. I appreciate that. Why, just behind Jamie, and I'm sorry, I forgot the name of the lady from Type Books, but what's your name again?
Alex.
Yeah, so Alex from Type Books will sell you a copy of the book right now for those who want to. Thanks, Jamie. I appreciate the plug there. Obviously, nobody's obligated or anything like that.
Here they are.
What's that?
Yeah.
Of course.
Signing the book?
Obviously, I will stick around, and I would be very happy to sign them this evening, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you, Jamie. Appreciate that. Now I forgot. What were the other? Oh, yeah, my next talk. So, and again, my next talk is May 16th at the University of Toronto, sponsored by the Centre for Inquiry. It's just a little bit different in that it's a ticketed event, but you can find the details online, and or just ask me or whatever, but it's May 16th, University of Toronto, and I put a link on my facebook.com/DanFalkWriters slide, and I also tweeted it recently, so anyway, basically.
That's the full talk.
Yeah, that's the whole deal, so it's more, I mean, this was terrific, but this will be like twice as long, and with slides and all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah, and then I've got on my website, and Chris here maintains my website, so thank you, Chris, for doing that. Sarah left. Sarah took the author. She had to go, but she took the author photo, so thank you to Sarah for the author photo. Later this spring, I've got other talks, so if you have friends in Hamilton, or if you have to pass through Hamilton, I've got a thing there in about 2 or 3 weeks. Ottawa, June 6th, I believe. Let me see. There's a few more. Mississauga in September, so, you know, there's stuff. I mean, they will all strongly overlap with each other, so this is not like the Grateful Dead, where you have to go and see everyone, but, like, yeah, you know, if you know someone in that town or something, or if you just want to see the whole deal. I mean, it is sort of lavishly illustrated and all that. What was their third question, Jamie? I'm trying to remember.
Well, what's next for you? As far as, do you have another book in the pipeline or some ideas that you're working on?
Yeah, I have some half-baked ideas. I do. A little early to say. I was a student this year. It's been kind of a busy year, so I'm finishing up an MA in History and Philosophy of Science from the IHPST, the Institute for the History and Philosophy of Science and Technology here at U of T, and I'm actually not quite done. I have to, like, write two essays, and one of them is like the big essay because it's the equivalent of an MA thesis, so I really ought to do that, but technically technically my student status is good till August 31st or something, so I have a bit of time to work on that, but yeah, I sort of have to focus on that. It's weird because it's like, am I a student or am I a journalist or am I the guy who writes books? So it's kind of been doing a bunch of things, but hopefully I can, like, maybe relax a little bit. But yeah, I do have some ideas that are just in the very early stages. Probably anything I'm not going to suddenly start writing about something radically different. History of science is kind of like a thing that obviously I've got into here, so the next book will probably still involve some aspect of the history of science. I doubt it will be the 16th and 17th centuries, because I think I've sort of done that now. You know what I mean? Not that it's... I don't mean the final word on that. I just mean it's my final word on that subject for now, and I think I'll find another sort of juicy bit of history to work on. But, yeah, I guess anything could happen, so, yeah. I mean, thanks for asking. I don't know what the future holds. That's why I always read the fortune cookie to see what's... I don't check my horoscope, because that's nonsense, but I do... Thank you for your question.
questions. Thanks, Dan. And again, I'm very grateful that you asked the Star Spot to participate. It was a real thrill to do the interview. And we'll probably see you again soon at some of these upcoming events. We do have some flyers here from the Star Spot. If anybody's interested in our show, it's up on Sunday nights, every other Sunday, starspotpodcast.com. You can check us out on iTunes or Ryerson Radio. And definitely please get a copy of that book while Dan is here to sign them. Thanks again, everybody, for coming out tonight.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot, mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li, marketing and promotions by Natalie Morkos, guest hosting by Denise Fong, news production by Benjamin Jenkins, news contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan, web design by Blair Renault, graphics by Carmina Svillens, and I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.